Time to go out and tend the garden. It is the peak of growing season. Everything is growing fast, and it's, man, I'm just so engaged out there. That's really life-saving at the moment. It is Sunday, June 10th of 2012. Welcome back to a nightclub, the nightclub, at the end of the world, the Lifeboat Hour, here on PRN. Amazing stuff going on. First of all, let me just say I'm really glad to be with everybody tonight, and we're going to see if we can find some good feeling to leave you with at the end of this show tonight. Let me just comment briefly up front at the start of the show about the growth of this network. It's just amazing. This is a quote that I got from a memo. We've been getting a lot more people visiting our site for the first time. PRN, averages 3,500 new visitors every day. And, you know, we know that mainstreams getting their butt kicked, but this is a sign that, there's a line from the movie JFK by Oliver Stone where, Mr. X, who was actually L. Fletcher Prouty, was talking to Jim Garrison. He says, people are fundamentally suckers for the truth. Well, I think we're seeing the results of that here. PRN memo also said, so if everyone keeps making great shows and continues the hard work, the people visiting the site will stay longer and maybe start liking a show or two. Also, if hosts write articles, let me have them, blah, blah, blah. And then they want strong plugs on iTunes. For all of the PRN shows, and my comment to that is, though I do have to point out, is that my show is the only show from this network, this show, that iTunes censors and refuse to allow to be covered by their media. And you know what my reaction is to that? Big deal. They can't stop people from hearing what people are hungry to hear now, and I just laugh at it. So, you know, there are other things that we need to talk about tonight. You know, let's go right to the big one that's out there. Rand Paul endorsed Mitt Romney for president. Okay, now let me go back to a little history here. In 1992, because I've been trying to talk about CIA and drugs for a long time, in 1991, and I had written to a short, floppy-eared Texan with a big nose. Name was Ross Perot. Hi, I'm Ross Perot. I'm here to tell you how, you know, anyway, and I'd actually spoken to Perot twice on the phone, and we'd exchanged some correspondence. And when he decided to make his run for president in 1992, I immediately volunteered. I'd been a freelance writer. I became the press spokesman for L.A. County, the second largest media market in the world, and I was plugged into the campaign. I was on CNN almost every day when we were ahead of Clinton and Poppy Bush in the polls. And I went through the period basically, we'd won the California primary. We didn't by numbers, but we kept anybody else from winning. And Perot had gone ahead of both those two jerks. Then all of a sudden, Ross Perot dropped out. And the LA Times ran a picture of me being hugged as I was crying my eyes out, being hugged by my very dear friend, Sue Powers. Sue was Mrs. Frances Gary Powers. She was the widow of the U-2 pilot, the CIA pilot, shot down over Russia. As a matter of fact, when I got married at the home that she and Frank Powers, he didn't go by Gary, used to live in, CIA's family stuff. But I watched what happened in 1992 and what Ross Perot sold us out. I guess maybe the big lesson is here, beware of Texas politicians with the initials RP. Now, at CollapseNet, and over the course of the campaign up till now, I had endorsed Ron Paul, and I had said very clearly his positions were the right positions. He was a stalking horse, just like Ross Perot was. And, you know, I had hope because I was very clear to me, as it is to all of us who have been laboring on this field to make people aware of the collapse of human industrial civilization, that there are no more tomorrows. Now there are some major differences, however. So Rand Paul this week, in order to assure the ascent of a dynasty, endorsed Mitt Romney. And it's pretty clear that we were sold out. And it looks that way. There might be some super secret backhanded whippo changeo martial arts political strategy in the offing here, but I doubt it. And I took that position on CollapseNet some months ago, and I did on this show, too. I mean, I said support Ron Paul because at least his positions are clear and they're accurate. And there was no guarantee that we were going to get the magic bullet or that the Easter money was going to arrive or that an honest president would occupy the White House of the United States of America. But what's majorly different this time, and some people have actually asked me to get involved now in urging Ron Paul to make a third party. Dude, that was done in 1992 with Ross Perot. I ain't going through that again. Once I realized we'd been sold out, I backed out then, and I'm not stupid enough to get in now. Besides that, there's no time. The world is out of time. We've covered that over the last week. But what's different now is that there are millions and millions of really energized Ron Paul supporters. And have a sip here. My throat's parched hot. Who are just on fire and who understand that there is no more second chance and there's no, you know, and what's different is these supporters aren't going to go away. And my bet is most of them clearly get what's been done to them. Now, there are a number of things that can happen between now and the election, but the Ron Paul supporters are now a movement in search of. And I would suggest perhaps now that they don't need a leader. Looking for leaders now is probably playing into the old paradigm. We don't need another hero. But we know what the issues are. Gary, in his last show, was talking about the Occupy movement. I'm not as hard on the Occupy movement as Gary. What I will say is that the Occupy movement had its shot. It came and gone. It did some amazing things. But I don't even think about going back to resurrecting or telling Occupy what to do. The universe is evolving so quickly that the solutions that were viable last October don't even apply to the reality we now see on a daily basis. Now, what else is going around the world? I mean, now check this out, because we're here because we understand the situation and we're preparing ourselves to survive it, but we also kind of sacredly acknowledge or pay historical mark to the ether about the things that we see going by in this world around us, because we are not separate from it. A Tennessee man, this is from Fox News, torched himself after learning of financial loss. He was expecting a big deal, and he doused himself with gasoline before lighting himself on fire at his West Knoxville home. You know, these are signs, of course, of very severe desperation. But we've had some amazing writing coming out this week. This is a quote from Chris Hedges from April 30th. I didn't catch this, but from Truthdig. But and Chris is always a little ahead of the curve, and it fits really right now. He writes, when civilizations start to die, they go insane. Let the ice sheets in the Arctic melt. Let the temperatures rise. Let the air, soil, and water be poisoned. Let the forests die. Let the seas be emptied of life. Let one useless war after another be waged. Let the masses be thrust into extreme poverty and left without jobs, while the elites, drunk on hedonism, accumulate vast fortunes through exploitation, speculation, fraud, and theft. Reality at the end gets unplugged. We live in an age when news consists of Snooki's pregnancy, Hulk Hogan's sex tape, and Kim Kardashian's denial that she is the naked woman cooking eggs in a photo circulating on the internet. Politicians, including presidents, appear on late-night comedy shows to do gags as they campaign on issues such as creating a moon colony. At times when the page is turning, that was a quote Louis Fernand Céline wrote in Castle to Castle, when history brings all the nuts together, opens its epic dance halls, hats and heads in the whirlwind, panties overboard. We have a call, Brian. Okay, I want to ask everybody else. I should have said no calls tonight, but I'm going to take this one call, Brian, from Livermore, because I got a lot to cover and I want to keep a thread. But, Brian, you're already on the phone. Hi, what's up?
Brian, I mean, sorry, Michael.
You're Brian.
I just watched a video from Penny Freeman. She was a former, campaign staff of Ron Paul, and it came out after the endorsement of Rand Paul. And she is pretty much saying that Ron Paul, the whole Ron Paul thing, he may be actually a psyop. And if you watch the video, it's an interview with Adam Kokesh, I think that's the name.
That's all irrelevant to me now. You know, he's out of the race. He's sold out, and understanding anything behind that is the booby prize at this point.
Can I ask you another question? Do you know a man named Stu Webb, and what are your thoughts about him?
Stu Webb. No, you're not going to sidetrack me there. I wouldn't buy a soft drink on the sidewalk if he was selling them. Thank you for calling. Okay, let me go back to what I was on tonight. As I mentioned, the Huffington Post, June 7th, that's just 3 days ago, military suicide rates surged to nearly one per day this year. Now, I have had throughout my long life many great connections to people in the military and brothers and sisters in arms and brothers and sisters, and I understand where they are. These are people who weren't psychopathic killers. They bought the line of propaganda and they volunteered to begin, they became warriors, and what they're realizing now is that everything that they have been serving is a lie and a fraud. They can find no honor in what the United States military has been and is being tasked to do, and the sickness and the insanity that Chris Hedges was just talking about to a grunt in the field is so transparently obvious that, you know, the lunatics have taken over. But it just breaks my heart because, you know, as a cop, I was near suicide in the battles that I've fought over the years. I've been near suicide many times, and I understand that headspace. And that moved me greatly, and so that's set me up for part of what I've decided to do with the rest of this show tonight. Oil prices are plummeting for all you denial people, but that's because the global economy is collapsing at breakneck speed. Demand is falling. I'm not going into the details. If you don't see it, that's your problem at this point. But there was one other really good piece of writing that I came across this week from a guy who I've read quite a bit of. And by the way, CollapseNet's doing a great job. Wes Miller and his crew. Wes Miller wrote an amazing three-part series called Tear Down This Wall, and CollapseNet is now standing on its own, and it has a real leader now, and I'm really glad to see that it's doing the deed, man, because it's good stuff, and I found this on the World News Desk at CollapseNet from Zero Hedge. Great writer Charles Hughes Smith, who has just been eloquent now for a couple of years. We've had many stories from him on CollapseNet. The title of his article from June 8, 2012 is "The Solution is Collapse." Yes. Yes. So the root problem is the system, human nature, blah, blah, blah. There are no solutions that can fix those defaults. Thus, the solution is collapse. Policies create incentives and disincentives. Some are intended, some fall into the category of unintended consequences, quoting Smith. Regardless of their intention, policies that create windfalls, easy money, or open spigots of free money, or what is perceived as free money by the recipient, quickly gather the allegiance of everyone reaping the windfall or collecting the free money. The allegiance is soon tempered into political steel by self-justification. Humans excel at rationalizing their self-interest. Thus, my share of the swag is soon absolutely essential. Humans don't need much incentive to pursue windfalls, Smith writes, or free money. Seeking windfalls in the here and now is our default setting. Taking the pulpit to denounce humanity's innate greed, avarice, and selfishness doesn't change this, as seeking short-term windfalls has offered enormous selective advantages for hundreds of thousands of years. That which is painful to those collecting free money will be avoided, and that which is easy will be pursued until it's painful. Borrowing $1.5 trillion a year from toddlers and the unborn taxpayers of the future is easy and painless, as toddlers have no political power. So we will borrow from the powerless to fund our free money spigots until it becomes painful. There is a sickness in humanity. That's my line. Maybe it's his, too. It's so obvious. This sickness is running throughout human industrial civilization, and yet at the same time some amazing things are happening. But tonight all around the world, there are people in their 20s and their 30s, even in their 40s, and they are now living in the same rooms they grew up in. They are imprisoned with monitors, keyboards, mouses, and texting as their prison guard, wondering what the fuck happened to what they were sold when they were growing up about how they were going to have Lexuses and cars and vacations and the good life. And there are a lot of people trapped tonight. And there's a way out. And that's the setup for where I'm going to go with the rest of the show. I don't think I'm going to be taking any calls at all tonight, but I want to set up now in our nightclub at the end of the world, the new white trash song. And I guess what happened in the Ron Paul campaign reminded me of this song. It's the last song that I was involved in writing at New White Trash, and I had received writing credits on, I think, 13 out of the 37 originals. But this was where I was really starting to come into my own, really learning how to receive a song. And that's what I call it. You receive a song, and I consider a song to be a child. And we had just laid down some tracks, and I had found the melody and lyrics for this song. And what happened was there was a major blow-up in the band. There was a huge feud between Doug Lewis and Andy Kravitz, and everything shut down. The music was gone. There was no chance of getting anybody back to record any other tracks. And what had happened with this song was the track you're going to hear was, as I discovered, if you will, or received the melody, it was my second take through after being given this skit, and it was a song I wanted to polish. If you're a singer, what you do when you write a song and you sing it is, you know, you experience the song coming out, and then you live with the song until it's woven into your DNA, and you rehearse it, and you produce extra tracks, and then you don't record the vocals, at least, until... you know, you've really got a living, breathing organism. It's a gestation period, or as the great songwriter Jimmy Webb used to say, you gotta put it in the oven and let it bake. But we never got the chance to do that with this song, and Doug Lewis, God bless him, rescued all of the music, and we saved it and we got it out. We're selling a bunch of albums lately, thank you. I don't know what's going on with that, but God bless everybody. But this was one I wept over because it was premature, and it was kind of deformed, but it was a really great song. And I remember how grateful it was when I received this melody. So this kind of goes with the Ron Paul fiasco and everything else right now. But then when you come back, when we come back after the song, I'm pretty confident I'm going to be able to raise your spirits between now and the end of the show. But here's a song called This Day Is Done.
Not quite yesterday, but this day is done. Not quite yesterday, but This day is done. Not quite yesterday, but this day is done. Not quite yesterday, but this day is done. Not quite yesterday.
Still like that song. So that was one we'd never played on the show before, because I never thought it got finished enough. But you know, things start and they sometimes lead to other things, and we just celebrate the energy that brings up. That's This Day Is Done from New White Trash. You can find that and 36 other originals at newwhitetrash.com. That's me and Doug Lewis. And as I said a couple weeks ago, Dougie's moving out here to where I am in Sebastopol, and we're going to do a studio. And between now and the end of the world, we're going to write another album, we're going to make some music, and we're going to just have a place of light and love here. Beats the alternative. So, all right, now, let's jump into the Wayback Machine. I want to tell you a little story. It goes way back, maybe before a lot of you were born. Let's set the Wayback Machine for January 30th of 1983. It was Super Bowl Sunday. And I had just moved about 5 weeks before. I'd lived in the west side of L.A. for a long time, but I had moved up to Van Nuys, 6666 Sepulveda Boulevard, a little single apartment, because I was broke. It was just about 4 years since I had been forced out of the Los Angeles Police Department for trying to talk about CIA dealing drugs, and it had not been an easy 4 years. I'd been homeless for much of that. I'd been unable to get employment. They were putting out bad references. I'd been arrested at a 7-Eleven store for selling liquor to a minor when that was the only job I could find was at a 7-Eleven store. I'd filed bankruptcy. I had spent about almost two of those years homeless, sleeping on people's sofas. And I had come back, and I was working as a lieutenant of 10 security guards, armed security guards, at a place called the Rodeo Collection at 421 North Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. Just drove through there not too long ago, and yeah, man, they're out spending like crazy. But what was catching up with me then was alcoholism. I had been, never had a drunk driving arrest. I was one of those, when I was a cop, especially as things were going south and the emotional stress of CIA and my fiance and all that, those are all excuses, by the way. But I had had very strong cravings, but I was in the grip of a very progressive illness, and it had gotten to the point. I mean, I was dead broke. I was driving a car that had like 200,000 miles on it. I was working for like $11 an hour. But the physical craving for alcohol had gotten so bad that when I got off work in the afternoon, I was never drunk at work, never drank on the job. But I knew the three closest places at which I could buy wine, and based upon traffic, I would rush to the closest one, so that I could get a bottle of chilled white wine to drink on the way home from Beverly Hills to Van Nuys. And the craving was so bad that I would continue to drink either until pass-out point at night or pass-out point at night. I would get up the next morning, shower, go to work, and I would, I was already planning the day for when I could have the next drink. Now, I had been suicidal before, but, and I had reasons to be self-piteous. I mean, I was a whistleblower who'd been trashed. My life had been destroyed. I found out that my government was crooked. Nobody really wanted to hear what I was talking about, and my problems were not run-of-the-mill stuff. But I was full of self-loathing, but I also was scared to death because I had absolutely no control over it. I was powerless. And on top of everything else that had happened in my life, and trying to go through the motions and act like I was, living an okay life, I had to deal with these cravings, and I was broke that day. I remember I only had about $7, and it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I needed a drink. The game was getting ready to kick off. So I drove to a local bar called Bourbon Square at Victory in Burbank. It's not there anymore. And the cravings were so bad, I ordered a beer because I was watching my money. I just, I'm going to drink through $7 or $17. I'm going to drink through this in about 2 seconds. Then what are you going to do? Because the kick of alcohol, which had been a $1 million high the first time that I got drunk, was now worth about 17 cents. And you kept chasing it. One drink, they say, is too many, and 10,000 not enough. You know, we're gonna complete the whole story tonight. So I went to Bourbon Square and I had a beer, and the craving, I just wanted to, and I was so bad at that time that when people weren't looking, I'd find a glass with a quarter of a drink in it, and I just chug that while I thought nobody was looking. But I'm sitting at the bar and I realize that there's no way I'm getting through the day. I'm trying to act, I'm trying to relieve my stress. And I started to cry. I just started crying right at the bar, and the bartender comes over and, "Oh man, what's wrong? You all right?" I said, "What the hell?" I said, "Oh man, I'm, my wife, she just left me. She took everything. She took, you know, she took the house, the dog, the car, the bank accounts. It's all gone, man. I got nothing." And I started doing, and like everybody at the bar started buying me drinks. Now the problem was I had never been married at that point, but it worked. And over the course of the football game, which I believe Philadelphia won, I hardly remember, I had like 9 double kamikazes and 6 beers. And I got I was asked to leave. I was kicked out of the bar because pretty drunk later on, I had missed singing so much. I had sung in a bar, and I just wanted something to connect. And I got up on stage and started singing with the band when they didn't ask me. So somebody drove me home, and that was a miracle. That was an angel. But I got home, and I had a half a gallon of wine at the house, and I started on the half gallon of wine. Now, what started at 2 o'clock, you get to around 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, and the problem was I'd had all that alcohol, and I was still sober. I was drunk on the outside and sober as a judge on the inside. And all the feelings that I had hoped that the alcohol would assuage, mitigate, take away, relieve, whatever, it was like pouring gasoline on a fire. I remember I tried to put my head in the oven. I didn't have a gun anymore. I had a, you know, there was a gun I kept in the locker that belonged to the company where I worked in Beverly Hills, but I didn't have money for that. You know, I barely had money to buy macaroni and cheese. And somewhere over the course of the night, I started to cry. And I had reached a place of surrender. Where I was absolutely and totally beaten, defeated. I had no more ideas. I couldn't explain why I'd lost my LAPD career with a perfect record. I couldn't explain anything, and now I had absolutely no control. Now, the beauty was that I'd had a band back in 82 for about 2 minutes, a couple of months, till a lead guitar player signed a record contract, Joe Casterdale. But one of the members of the band had been a sober member of AA, and that was how I had been exposed to my first meetings. And I saw all these happy people. But the seed had been planted. I knew I had a drinking problem, but I was nowhere near ready to surrender yet. And because I hadn't experienced complete defeat, and you're going to hear me repeat that over and over again. Now we're going to come up on a station break, but right now. But I want to leave you with a thought. I sat there for maybe 3 hours just crying, and I could only get one word out of my mouth, one of the deepest cries I've ever had. The snot was hanging down my nose, down to the middle of my chest. It was like the only word I could get out of my mouth was Jesus. Now, if you know me, I'm not a born-again anything. But hey, man, he was a cool guy, you know? But I was absolutely, absolutely broken. There was no hope. I could see no way out. I could see no answer. There was no justification. There was nothing that I knew to do. And that's where I passed out. And on that, we will take a station break here at the Lifeboat Hour on PRN-FM, and we're going to pick that up right after we come back.
You say, why me? Why me, you ask? And then you know you're running. Trash. You say, why me? Why
strategies out there. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour. That was kind of appropriate also. Why me? Why me, you ask? So there we were, and I was completely defeated. My mind, I couldn't even formulate any other word to say, but basically it was help. And if this sounds like there might be a parallel for the human race, just roll with me on this. It's going to become a lot more apparent as we go on here. So I passed out for a few hours, and when I woke up, the thought was in my head, call AA. And I did, and I was directed to the Radford Clubhouse at 4343 North Radford. It's not there anymore, but it was a legendary clubhouse in AA history. And I walked in the door just before the noon meeting. I'd taken a shower, actually two showers, but I still smelled like booze. You could smell the booze oozing out of my pores from 10 feet away. And from out of the office came this elderly blonde woman named Alabama. Ah, can I help you? And she was a legend, and she was amazing. And I just said, I'm an alcoholic. I help. And I was crying. And all unconditional love. There's some themes that are going to repeat here about things that human beings are going to have to remember. And I was offered unconditional love, and I was given to the care of, believe it or not, an Al-Anon. That's somebody who wasn't an alcoholic, but who had been married to one for 35 years. And his method of working a spiritual program to help others was to help new members coming in. And he really reached me. And what he said, what I was told very simply that first day before the meeting started, was that you suffer from a condition that no human power can cure. There is no form of psychology, psychiatry, medicine, anything else. Now, I'm going to leave aside all the debates about other ways to cure and to treat alcoholism. This was the way I found, because it was the spiritual approach beyond that which made everything that I have accomplished in my life since then possible. And I sat in the meeting, and at the beginning of every meeting, they read a portion of Chapter 5 from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a copy of the second edition sitting here right here on the desk next to me. And it very succinctly outlined what the program was and what it was about. But the key thing to remember, and I may not read all of the 12 steps tonight. If you're curious enough, Google it. And then, once you have read what the 12 steps are and what they entail, remember that you don't understand really, you may have a fundamental idea, but you haven't got it fully figured out, and you can't do it alone. And there's a reason why they put numbers on the steps. I learned that lesson later on. But as they opened the meeting, and I looked at this room full of happy, smiling people, and there were bikers. There was a guy named Sonny C, who had been in the Hell's Angels, who had been on death row. What was his name? A crazy one-eyed Mexican with .638 caliber belly buttons. He was amazing. He was just a giant. Joe, I want to say his name was. And there were businessmen, and everybody was just getting along. And I looked at them, and as I was crying, a couple of people were holding on to me. I felt the desire to drink and use, and we could apply that to things like feeling the desire for infinite growth, or to restore a political system that's totally corrupt, or to restore an economic system that's collapsing, or an environment that has passed multiple tipping points. But I felt the desire to drink and use be lifted out of me. It just went away. I was, as they say in the trade, struck sober. Now, to paraphrase both Albert Einstein and Carl Jung, who had a big hand in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous, once you know there is a God, it makes no difference whether you believe in one or not. And with that great blessing, I started on a spiritual journey which continues to this very day. And I have, even though I stopped being a member, an active member of AA in 2004 in the middle of writing Crossing the Rubicon, I have lived by those 12 steps every year since. Because as we said on a previous show, there are several key passages in the Big Book, but That's one old-timer called in last week and said, you know, on top page 77, our primary purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to our fellow human beings. And the core of Alcoholics Anonymous is that one drunk helps another. Because people who have suffered have credibility. That's where we get compassion from. I know I've been there. When I can sit and talk to a ranger or a special forces guy or somebody else who's all fucked up or talk, I can say I've been, they know that I've been there. And that's a credibility. Now, we are all being there right now in the middle of the collapse of human industrial civilization, and it's important for that generation of 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds locked in the same room that they're living, you know, that they grew up in with no hope to understand that there might be and there is another way. Now, one of the first things that I was told is, you pick your own conception of God. They don't deal in religion. So if you're listening to this show tonight and you think this is some kind of a religious diatribe, it is not. Spirituality in Alcoholics Anonymous is treated exactly and like impartial electricity. If you orient yourself to the electricity, you will get a power to change your life. And what you have to know is it doesn't make any difference what your conception of spirit or God or a higher power is. The one thing you have to be clear on is it's not you. We are trapped in our ego. We are living, as Gary was so eloquently talking about, in a culture, a civilization centered on the self. As one old-timer in AA put it to me once, he said, Mike, your problem is not that you think highly of yourself. Your problem is not that you think lowly of yourself. Your problem is that you think constantly of yourself. And what I was taught and what I learned through many, 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 many hard years of sobriety, which was like my spiritual boot camp, was that when everything else in the world fails, no matter how low I am, if I am desperate and hopeless and I've tried everything I can think of to feel better, I go out and I find somebody else to help, because in that moment I am not thinking about myself. And we did that, Real Alcoholics, and I was able to sponsor many men over the course of 21 years, 1 month, and 13 days. I had the same sponsor all of that time, Dale F. Just that this man saved my life with his unconditional love and his gentleness, and he lived and he shared, he still does, he's about 36 years sober now, from his heart. And he put his heart out on the table every time he shared from a podium. He put his heart out in your lap any time that he listened to you or talked to you. And that, and he and I are still, I still love the man. But then came the work. Now, I, of course, since evolved, but there is work that has to be done. Once you make a decision, the third step says you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him, or her, or it. And then after that, all you've done is make a decision. You have to work steps 4 through 9, which have to do with house cleaning. And from the spiritual perspective, what AA is all about is what every other mystical discipline is all about. The journey is not out into the world. The journey is inside. And what has to be cleared away inside is the wreckage that we have created or has been created for us, but that we carry around. We pack our shit up in suitcases and we lug it from town to town and place to place and all throughout our life thinking it's my shit. I've got to have it with me. But there is work that has to be done to go inside so that we can see how our own selfishness, not give me more, but, you know, selfish and self-centeredness had placed us in a position to be hurt and allowed us to realize that by taking actions to clear away that wreckage, you open a channel to a power that is inside. And this is a power, my friends, that is inexhaustible. The only power that is. And I lived with complete dedication for 21 years, 1 month, 13 days. I didn't do a joint, a pill, a beer, anything. I counted every day, and I was always grateful for everyone because I considered it to be a gift. Now, we fast forward 21 years, and this is after, you know, sponsoring many men and speaking, and trust me, I've read the book in the 12 and 12. But I was at a point of frustration because I was getting little spiritual nutrition from the program itself. And by then I had set myself apart. You see, when I got sober in 1983, I had not yet confronted John Deutsch. I had not met Gary Webb. I had not started From the Wilderness. I had not written Crossing the Rubicon. But that was my calling, because there were two prayers which I think really changed my life completely. And again, I'm not praying to any religion. I'm praying to anything out there that's greater than me that can do a better job of running this universe than perhaps I can, because our heads are what have brought us collectively to this point as a civilization and a species. Now, there is a third step prayer where you offer, where you make a decision to turn your life and your will over to the care of God. And the third step prayer has been one of the three prayers that have carried me through all the years since, more than any other. It says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, the prison that we're in. That's my line. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life, may I do thy will always. Now, it was shortly after that that I had been working my own steps, and I was into the ninth step. According to the Big Book, that's the time when you have had, and it's true, you've had a really serious change in consciousness, and you're fit to sponsor other people and take them through the steps. But I was young. I was only about 15 months sober, and I was dealing with a lifetime full of demons. My mind didn't start with LAPD. I was a victim of sexual abuse from my mother. There was alcoholism in my family. There was domestic violence. So I had a lot of stuff to clean up, but I had been sponsoring a Vietnam veteran, and I heard his fifth step, which is that's where you tell someone else all of your life story. And believe me, it's a wonderful, liberating experience. But I had listened to this guy's fifth step, and he had been with the 9th Infantry in Vietnam, and he had raped 11-year-old girls with a bayonet. And so I heard his fifth step, and I was loving, and I received it, and called my sponsor. I went to bed that night, and I woke up the next morning, and I was totally suicidal. It had stirred so much stuff in me. And I went into the bathroom where I lived, and I tied a terry cloth bathrobe around my neck, tied the belt around my neck, and draped it over the shower rod. I actually got my feet off the floor, and then the shower rod broke, and I fell on the floor. I said, oh, okay, I'll go to a meeting. I can hear the AAs laughing their butt off at that. And my sponsor's best friend, Pete Padilla, he's dead now, that's why I can say his last name. Wonderful, oh my God, just a light. Couldn't barely read, but he was just glowing with spiritual energy. And I go to the clubhouse, and I'm crying, and my neck's all red, and he says, what's wrong? And, I told him what was going on. I just couldn't deal with the noise inside my head. And he looked at me and he said, hey, did you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him? Yeah, Pete, I really did. Did you mean it? Crying. Yeah, I did. I had meant it with all my heart. And then he looks at me and he says, well, what makes you think you can take it back? So the other prayer that has carried me was the prayer from the seventh step, where we realize that we're human and we carry character defects. And the seventh step prayer says, my creator, I am now ready that you should have all of me, good and bad. Too many people feel like going to spirit is like you have to go to the dentist, and they'll spend hours cleaning their teeth so that they can have clean teeth to go see the dentist to get their teeth cleaned. It's not the way it works. Spirit likes it when you come messy and dirty. So the prayer says, I'm willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Remove from me every single character defect of character, which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do thy bidding. And what that prayer clearly says is that my character defects, some of them are useful. And they have been. Now, what happened with me was after 21 years, the collapse of human industrial civilization and the overt corruption in my government was my life. And that was my calling. That was where spirit led me. And obviously it has been a productive and fruitful path in the years since. I was in the middle of writing Crossing the Rubicon. And I had trouble with people who took a passage from page 449 of the second edition and used it as a means of ignoring what was going on in the world. And it starts with acceptance is the answer to all of my problems. Nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And that was being sold to me as endorsement, that I should see peak oil, that I should see the criminality behind 9/11, that I should see the economic corruption, and that I should just roll with it. No, no, because AA has another great book called The 12 and 12, The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, great writing. And in the 11th step, and I think the third step, it talks about the sober AAs fighting on the Anzio beachhead. But yet AAs would say, you can't fight anything. But I said, wait a minute, it talks about AAs, some things are worth fighting. But so I had reached a point with that where the rooms were stifling to me because I couldn't bring all of me into the rooms. It was, you know, it was kind of a subject of, but I wasn't resentful. Because what happened on the night of, I think it was March 13th of 2004, I had just compiled all of the war game evidence in one place, and I'm writing that chapter in Crossing the Rubicon. And for the first time, this included information that had been revealed to me, forwarded to me by very high-ranking people in the Defense Department. And I had it all laid out in front of me, all of the war game exercises thoroughly under the control of Richard Cheney, and I saw how 22 false radar blips had been injected on the screen. I saw how the fighters had been moved out of the country to Alaska, to Canada, to Iceland, to Greenland. I saw how the communication systems had been overridden. I saw how I had just learned, I had on the record confirmation from a wonderful heroic Air Force major named Don Arias at 1st Air Force at Tyndall. That's where my dad had trained the interceptors. Confirming that on the day of 9/11, the Department of Defense was running a live fly hijack exercise with a jet posing as a hijacked airliner. So there was no possibility that any of the eight fighters left in the region or so could have intercepted the hijacked planes, because they couldn't pick them out from all the chaff that was on the screen. They didn't have enough fuel to fly. Fighters had to fly. And it was all there in front of me. And to my knowledge, I was the only person not covered by a secrecy oath or covered, you know, who was a part of that conspiracy to have that information in front of him. And as I was sitting there I was scared to death. I mean, I had to find the courage to write that out and accuse the Vice President of the United States of being one of the most evil, cold-blooded murderers in the world. And the thought came into my head, because I wasn't getting the support I needed. Do you mean to tell me, I was talking to God, I talk to God a lot, still do, and talk to Spirit a lot, and do you mean to tell me that if I pick up a glass of wine now, I'm going to become a blithering idiot, and this story, which you led me my whole life to find out, and you now are challenging me to put down on paper and have the balls to talk about, that if I have a drink, I'm going to go insane and all this stuff is going to go away? So what happened was I was not seeking to go back to drinking. I was trying to understand my relationship to God and what I thought I was being asked to do, which was so much bigger than I was. And I had a glass of wine, and I wasn't struck dead. And so what I learned out of that, for me, was that having lived the 12 steps, and I believe AA says that, allows that, because they do talk about a state of being recovered. Now, what they say is you can't go back to drinking again, and that's obvious for the sake of the newcomers who come in, because newcomers will come in and delude themselves. Until I've worked the steps, now and they crash the car, they commit suicide, whatever. I wasn't seeking that outcome, but that outcome was a byproduct. And I called my sponsor, Dale, a few days later. He understood completely. He said, Mike, you had to leave to get well. But Dale knows. Dale knows with his heart that I have lived the steps and loved the steps with the same purpose to serve my fellow man all this time, because that's the only way that I could have stayed sane through everything that has been thrown at me through all the years since. Now, humankind is at that point now, and what's different before is that now the human race is at a point where we might become empathic enough and heads out of our butt enough to all of us hit that bottom at the same point. And when we do, there will be a change of consciousness, and there will be solutions. there will be ways to go, because essentially what spirituality says is you can live from either a place of fear or from love. It's that simple. And we all know what choice I've made along the way, and I have to, and I'm having a, you know, I'm very much at peace right now, and I'm growing a lot. But this is what I've been aching to share. I didn't want to irritate the people in AA, but you know, the people in AA, especially all the old timers who still remember me in Sherman Oaks, North Hollywood, Studio City, around there. I'm not doing this to make a buck. My motive is the same as it always has been, to be of service to God and to my fellow man, and I'm in this unique position of having watched this. Now, every scientist in the world will have looked at AA, and that's why it was such a success when it first started, and they say, we cannot explain this. This is spiritual power. It works. There's no rational way to explain it, but it has done what medical science and all the science in humankind hasn't been able to do for 6,000-7,000 years, which is to take people who have been placed themselves beyond human aid and give them a new hope and a new life in what they called, out of the big book, the fourth dimension. So being the objective, being the reporter that I have been my whole life, and if I've earned no respect for anything else, I have earned the respect. And obviously, since I left AA, I'm doing fine. We have two books, the movie, the documentary Collapse. We have Collapse Net. We have, you know, so. That's held everything together for me, even up till now, and it's what I'm living on now, is that same spiritual perspective, because I'm the guy who knows, who understands more about what's happening than pretty much anybody else out here. That's what my career has been. But I've reported honestly, and that's all I'm doing now. Now, I was thinking toward the end of the show, there is a great passage. We're going to talk about this in future shows. We will talk about the bedevilments, which really describe the world as a whole, and the promises as a result. Because all of those, if you take those and not write them not about an individual, but if you write them about a civilization or our species or our consciousness, they all apply. And I cannot not talk about it in good conscience. But I want to leave you guys tonight with something that's read pretty much at the end of every meeting. And it's a very powerful passage from page 164 of the second edition. There's so much wisdom in this book, especially the mechanics of how to. But what it takes first is complete defeat. You must understand this. It says throughout AA literature, stress on your prospect, that's when you meet a newcomer, that the more hopeless he feels, the better. Well, that's where this planet is. And I want all you military, my brothers and sisters, you listen to this. Don't give up. So this is called A Vision for You. And I'm going to read this and I'll leave the show and I'll be back with you next week and we'll see what Spirit has to bring up. I've got to plant this seed. I don't have time to write the book. We don't have time for that. You know, what we have time to do is what I said in the movie, to change our minds, to have a drastic rearrangement of our emotional and intellectual natures. And that only happens when you've been beaten into a state of reasonableness. But here's what you get. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you. Until then. We'll be back on PRN FM with another episode of the Lifeboat Hour 1 week from tonight. I love you. Good night.